You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
this current government in Iraq has never fulfilled the commitments it made to bring a unity government together with the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shia. We have worked hard with them within the confines of our ability to help them do that, but we can't dictate.
As America weighs up Iraq's invitation to send its Air Force for an encore, we'll have journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman and the former Shah d'affaires in Pyongyang, Jim Hoare, discussing that and the day's other big stories. Also ahead, as we continue to leaf through Monocle's new quality of life issue, we discuss London, one of the world's great cities, if only anyone could afford to live in it.
London's housing problem has become too big to ignore. Prices are too high, whether buying or renting, and there aren't enough homes to go around. That much everyone can agree on. The difficult part is working out what to do next.
And as Spain's reign ends with them on an early plane, we'll ask the author Jimmy Burns where it all went wrong for La Roca. All that plus a review of the latest literature with Kathy Rensenbrink from The Bookseller and maybe some music as well. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. Ahead of all that, however, the latest news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Iraqi government forces continue to battle Sunni rebels for control of the country's biggest refinery, north of the capital, Baghdad. Large clouds of smoke have been seen coming from the huge site, but all staff have been allowed to leave the complex during a truce. On Wednesday, Iraq appealed for US air power to help fight back the militants across the north of the country, but Washington has been expressing the need for a political solution. President Obama is due to speak to reporters shortly. The European Union's counter-terrorism coordinator Gilles de Kerchov says he believes hardline Islamist groups are training and directing foreign fighters to carry out attacks in Europe and elsewhere. Mr. de Kerchov said it was vital to seek a better understanding of possible links between terror activity in and beyond Europe.
I'm worried, and I think it's likely. The question is whether Nemouche, person suspected to be behind the Brussels terrorist attack, was directed to do that, or he was just inspired and did it by himself. I think it's very likely that the ISIS, which the Arab called Daesh, the most extremist group there, alongside Jabhat al-Nusra, maybe is preparing, training, directing some of the foreign fighters to mount attack in Europe or outside Europe.
A Turkish court has today ordered the release of 230 military officers convicted of plotting to topple Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan. The announcement comes a day after the country's top court ruled their trial was flawed. Swedish police have sealed off parts of Stockholm's old central town, including the headquarters of the Social Democrat Party and the ruling Conservative Moderates Party, after a bomb threat received this afternoon. The new King of Spain has called for people to work together to rebuild the country as it recovers from the economic crisis. Felipe VI has officially taken over from his father, Juan Carlos, after he abdicated earlier this month. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has praised the Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt today, saying there's no reason why the next president of the European Council should not come from a non-Eurozone country such as Denmark. British officials have mentioned Thorning-Schmidt for the role of European Commission President, but the 47-year-old Social Democrat has also been touted as a possible successor to European Council President Herman Van Rompuy, who chairs EU summits. Mrs. Thorning-Schmidt said the content laid out in the policy agenda to be outlined by leaders next week was more important than who would carry it out.
The main purpose of our summit next week is to define the general political direction for our union over the coming years. And the way I see it, the EU needs to demonstrate that we are able to deliver tangible results in the areas that matters most to our citizens.
One of the Eurozone's most senior economic advisers says investor enthusiasm for Eurozone debt could be abruptly reversed and governments should not bank on borrowing costs remaining super low. The comments from Klaus Rebling of the European Stability Mechanism come weeks after the European Central Bank issued a similar warning. That's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Thanks, James. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
18.06 or near enough in London, which will be 13.06 in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and joining me now with their take on the news, the journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman and the former British Shah d'Affaires in Pyongyang, Jim Hoare, now of the Centre of Korean Studies at SOAS here in London. We'll start with Iraq, which yesterday formally asked the United States to launch airstrikes against the ISIS insurgency currently engulfing the northwest of the country. Today, reports suggest that the US might be inclined to go along with this on the condition that Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki step aside. President Obama is due to begin speaking on this and other subjects in about 7 minutes. Al-Maliki, doubtless aware that his retirement options are probably limited, has declared that he will not be part of such an arrangement. Jeffrey, I'll ask you first, does it sound plausible that the US would make an ultimatum of this sort? There's no official confirmation of this yet, but there's a lot of noise around this, both from the likes of John McCain and Dianne Feinstein.
I think this is one of those geopolitical stories where what's said publicly and what's said privately are often different, and we won't actually know. But of course, we won't interfere and tell Iraq how to govern itself.
Imagine America doing that.
Yeah, or anywhere else, exactly. And so effectively, too. I think that clearly there's pressure there and pressure, and I'm sure some pretty strong domestic pressure, too. A lot of what's happening in Iraq is on Maliki's shoulders.
I just can't imagine who else in Iraq would be silly enough to want the job. Jim Hoare, would it make any difference at this point to the immediate future of Iraq if al-Maliki is elbowed aside?
I can't see that, one man is the key to the whole thing. This is a structural thing that was created by bringing down Saddam Hussein and not really creating anything to take his place properly. And, it's going to come back, and it's going to come back. And I can't see that you can say the key is the current prime minister.
I think that really, well, that's true. The question now is, has the one opportunity been squandered, and will there be another? We have this. One of the things you have that I find when I talk about the Middle East is that people get so confused by the terms Shiite and Sunni. And, indulge me while I just explain that 90% of the world's Muslims are Sunni.
Yeah.
About just under 90 and just over 10% are Shiite. You have a concentration of Shiites dominating the populations in Iraq and Iran and Bahrain. Those are the three major centers, Bahrain being a very small player here. Saddam, being a Sunni in the minority, oppressed the Shiites. Now we have a Shiite prime minister in Maliki who said, forget conciliation, forget reaching out in that Mandela way. I'm just going to squash those guys who squashed my fathers and me. And so that's the nature of the animus. Thank you for indulging the little history lesson here, but I do think it's helpful to understand that. And so the point being here, Maliki was the one who needed to be Mandela, and he chose the route that most have chosen, which is vengeance. And now, to get back to your original question, can anyone come in and fix this? It was a mess before. It's a bigger mess now.
America is in about the last position it wants to be in. It occurred to me that maybe if this is a thing, that insisting that al-Maliki step aside, that in much the way that the United States set impossible conditions in 2003 to avoid a war, which was that Saddam and his son should sort of amicably pack their bags and push off, is the United States possibly now setting impossible conditions in order to keep out of a war in Iraq?
I have this proposal, and I want to float it here, and should it take off, I want you all to acknowledge that it began around the table here at Monocle. I think that the U.S. and the U.K. should appoint two emissaries to go to Iraq and sort this out. The American George W. Bush and the Brit Tony Blair should both be sent to Baghdad, and they should be told you can't leave until you fixed it.
Well, that's the end of them then, isn't it? We shan't be seeing them for some time.
Jim, you do have more direct experience than most than diplomacy in difficult circumstances. If you are a representative of a somewhat suspected outside Western power in this case, which anybody dealing with Iraq is, and even if you are now in a position where Iraq is requesting your involvement, how would you even begin to approach this, given that I think the United States, both its government and its public, really don't ever want to hear about Iraq ever again?
I think that's the problem. If you've got ministers or officials who want to get involved, then you can make a case. It's easy enough to make a case. Everybody can do that. If you don't want to get involved, you've really got to, and in a sense you are involved because of what happened in the past, you've got to scratch around and argue this way and that way to make sure that you are covering your back so nobody can criticize you for failure for humanitarian reasons or whatever it might be, but also that, you know, you come out looking clean. And I can't see that anybody can come out of this looking clean.
Barack Obama is, as we speak, going over his final notes before making some sort of statement on this very subject. If, as seems likely, I think, that there is no way for Iraq to stay in one piece. Actually, there may be no way for Iraq to stay in one piece, but it's certainly very hard to see that happening without some sort of support or intervention from the United States. If you are President Barack Obama, who didn't support the war in 2003, how do you go about trying to sell this to an American public, which, as we were just discussing, really did not want to hear the word Iraq ever again?
Well, that's an interesting question, because you're right. Americans just don't want to know about it. They know that this was a colossal blunder, a huge cost in human life, both for American and NATO soldiers, allied soldiers, as well as for Iraqis, and also costing billions to the U.S. Treasury. And they just don't want to revisit. They want to just close this and go back to watching Jersey Shore. You know, unfortunately, it's just not that easy. And so how does Obama walk that line? You know, he's going to talk piously as he always does, about the need for Iraq to determine its own future and to be inclusive and to respect one another. I can't imagine that he'll come out and say Maliki must go, because that would be interfering. And
absolutely.
Even though they do interfere, as we've already all agreed.
Maliki won an election and everything.
Right, exactly. But he doesn't have a majority in Parliament. He still needs to create a coalition that gets him over the 50% mark. And it's not clear he can do that. The problem is that the opposition is so divided and it's so diverse that it's not clear they can do it either. So I don't know. I think that he may talk about these advisors that he's sending in, these military advisors he's sending in at the request of the Iraqi government to help them. But, you know, I think Obama has very few options. I think we can talk in a moment about getting into bed with Iran.
We will get to that briefly. But in terms of Britain's outlook on this, Jim, we've seen David Cameron making some slightly familiar sounding speeches about how doing nothing is not an option. If we don't stop ISIS there, they will come here, etc. We're discussing the fact that Americans are heartily sick of hearing the word Iraq. How damaged do you think was the British public's appetite for interventions, humanitarian or otherwise, by what happened 11 years ago?
I think that Britain doesn't. My reading of the British public is that they don't want to get involved in Iraq again. And there's another one that we haven't mentioned that's possibly coming down the line as well, and that's Afghanistan. I mean, you know, Afghanistan is not guaranteed to hold together. It's never been held together in the past except for very short periods. So it's not just Iraq. It is also Afghanistan as well that must be giving a lot of concern to people at the moment.
And I suppose the sell for Americans is probably, you know, what I, as a journalist, sometimes call scare America. You know, you need to care about this because the, and I find that quite a nauseating and hackneyed approach to conversation and dialogue in America often. But in this case, it is true that chaos in these countries is a massive threat to global stability and ultimately to American security, not global security, really. And so that's why people should care. But I think
all of which is true. But the trouble is governments get into that oversell of trying to make people care by conjuring up these ludicrous demons and monsters which turn out not to exist.
Crying Wolfowitz. Yeah.
But if you do get involved, then some of those demons and monsters, as Mr. Cameron has said, may turn up on our shores. And allegedly, some of them have already gone to Iraq.
You just can't contain in this global world. And that is the problem, isn't it? If these countries become even less stable, then they do become breeding grounds for extremism and potential terrorism.
And well, in Iraq, we have this long tradition of involvement, which the Iraqis remember very closely.
Well, we will move on to a country just adjacent to Iraq, which also has fairly long memories about this kind of thing. The current crisis in Iraq has provided one of the more picturesque recent illustrations of Lord Palmerston's dictum that nations have no permanent friends or enemies, only permanent interests. And one of the nations sharing the UK and US's interest in Iraq not turning into Yugoslavia, but worse, is Iran. Britain is reopening its embassy in Tehran. Secretary of State John Kerry has said that the US is open to talking with Iran about Iraq. Jim, I'll come to you first. This is just reasonable, isn't it? This is just real politics. There is no, if there is a solution in Iraq, which is an open question, there isn't one without Iran, is there?
I think that's true, but I think there's also other reasons why we want to be back in Iran. And that's what the reason why we started negotiating to reopen the embassy. I mean, Iran could be an important trading partner and all sorts of other things. But it's also part of the whole key to the Middle East. And whatever happens in Iraq, you still need somehow to bring Iran in and solve the problems that there are, that the nuclear issue, like we've solved the North Korean nuclear issue and a few others. But it's important, I think, within government it'll be seen as important that we talk to Iran about other things, not just Iraq. But obviously that's made it even more on the table than it was before.
How gingerly does the United States, Jeffrey, have to tread both publicly and privately in terms of having any kind of engagement with Iran?
Well, you know, I think that the memories of the Iran hostage crisis are still very fresh for a lot of Americans, and the suspicions of towards the Ayatollahs. It's a very difficult one. It's interesting to see how the hawkish Republicans are dealing with this. You have Lindsey Graham, who's usually in bed with John McCain on foreign policy
issues,
and very
much on the right hand side of that bed.
Exactly. Well said. Well said. We're not going to go
into that.
Let's just
try and get that visual
right,
image out of
family
our
radio
heads
program
for the moment.
Lindsey Graham is actually saying, yes, it is time to talk to Iran. John McCain is saying, absolutely not. I think there's just a reality here. Iran is at the center of a lot of the instability that's going on. And certainly Iran has had a large hand in the instability in Syria. Reaching out to Iran, especially with the change of regime, with Ahmadinejad moving on a year ago, there is an opening for some sort of talk. It's very complicated, though. This whole nuclear issue, the long history of animus, it is fascinating to see as they try to navigate this. But we're not talking about formal military alignment. We're not talking about Iranian soldiers and American soldiers marching in lockstep. We're talking about things like the Americans saying to the Iranians, if this goes ahead, we're going to be bombing this part of Iraq. Don't shoot us down. That's the kind of cooperation we're talking about at the most basic level. But even that is a pretty big step, given the history.
Well, you talk there about the impossible prospect of, you know, American and Iranian soldiers fighting shoulder to shoulder. But there are mixed reports that suggest that 500 Revolutionary Guards from Iran are already in Baghdad.
Well, mixed, as you say, because one part of Iran China is saying it's happened, and then
another part
and then the
it,
Prime Minister is saying, no, it hasn't happened.
It's not. But it is not altogether impossible to imagine scenarios in which you effectively had Iranian troops battling ISIS on the ground with the US Air Force providing cover from the air.
Well, 500 troops are not a. I mean, that's not exactly an army. I mean, that's
not yet.
I think we don't want to get ahead of ourselves in that. But it, you know, certainly it's conceivable. Listen, Iran has a bigger stake in this than America. Iran,
indeed,
they're neighbors, and as much as they are a Shia Muslim population, and much bigger, 76 million, I think, is the population of Iraq versus Iran versus 34 million in Iraq. As much as they are happy to see the Shias dominate in Iraq, they're not happy to see massive instability on their doorstep. And so, mind you, they were pretty good at helping create it in Syria, but they really have to get want to see this brought under control. And they worry about a counter-terrorist state on their doorstep, and so, you know, they do have to bring that. They have a big vested interest here.
Jim, former Shah d'affaires for the United Kingdom in Pyongyang, that you were, you have that's fairly direct experience of helping establish a diplomatic presence where there's been a certain amount of rancor in the past. For the first British diplomats who go back to open up that embassy again, which, you know, was closed after being invaded and ransacked a couple of years ago. What are the first steps in rebuilding a relationship like that?
I think those are taken outside the country. The contacts have been built up and will be going on. The negotiations will be taking place either possibly in Europe somewhere but not in the country itself. We have plenty of a track record of re-establishing embassies in Iran. I mean, we've been sacked and thrown out several times. So there'll be even in the Foreign Office, which
doesn't buy really good furniture.
The Foreign Office, which doesn't necessarily keep precedence of such things, will know something of what to do in this case. I think there are lots of people within the Foreign Office who will be quite keen to go to Iran. There wasn't anybody keen to go to Pyongyang apart from me. So it's different in that sense. There's a lot of Persian speakers about. So, and there are people who have worked in the embassy in the past. It's going to be relatively easy in terms of the practical things of setting it up. Actually, re-establishing links with the Iranian government on the ground and a working relationship, that's going to be much more difficult.
Because I cannot claim to be an authority on Iran, having once spent about 36 hours in Tehran, but even in that brief period, I did notice that people's attitudes towards me adjusted vastly in my favour when I explained to them that I wasn't British but Australian.
Yes, well,
they have very long memories.
They do, and I don't know whether the British Embassy is still on Bobby Sands Street, but it used to be, and the embassy's been there for a long time, and the Iranians renamed it to make a point. I think it is a very complex and difficult historical relationship with intervention. Most famously with Mossadegh, who was ousted as prime minister. And it needs to be handled very carefully. What you really don't want to be doing is against the backdrop of another crisis just on the corner in Iraq. And that will make it much more difficult.
It's really interesting, though, to watch this, because this is not something that you would have imagined could happen a year ago, and yet these kind of the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of relationships happen in the real
Indeed.
World, and sometimes they lead to unexpected little flowerings. Sometimes they don't, of course, but maybe this is forcing something that's long overdue.
Okay, well, we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, the journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman, and the former British Shah d'affaires in Pyongyang, Jim Hoare. When we return, we'll be looking at Prime Minister Lee's visit to the UK.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring?
If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me is the journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman and the former British Shah d'affaires in Pyongyang, Jim Hoare. China's Prime Minister visited the United Kingdom this week. He visited the Queen, suggested that Scotland shouldn't leave the UK, perhaps fearing Tibet summoning its inner Braveheart, and signed £14 billion worth of trade deals. Jim Hoare, is it weird, first of all, we talk about the Prime Minister meeting the Queen, that the head of government would be received by the head of state?
There's several precedents. Previous Chinese premiers have been received by the Queen as well. I think there's some exaggeration about, you know, the Queen only sees heads of state. She does see other people from time to time as well. and in China, the relationship is not quite as clear cut as it might seem. The Prime Minister, in fact, is a very powerful figure. And I think that's the reason the Queen has seen him on this occasion. But she saw others as before that.
I do like the storyline, though, that he had a tantrum and said, "I'm not coming if I don't get to meet the Queen." I mean, it does sound kind of plausible.
It wouldn't be the first time a minister rather more junior insisted on seeing her.
Can you imagine the phone call? Oh, blast, Philip, I've got to meet
him. I'm sure Her Majesty doesn't say such things. The curious thing in some ways is, I mean, if you think 25 years ago, I was in Beijing. I was there during Tiananmen and afterwards. And in fact, around this time, we were just welcoming our families back from Hong Kong, having learned that the world wasn't going to collapse all around us. And at that point, you know, relations between Britain and China seemed pretty low. And
on the subject of countries with long memories about Britain, China has very much afflicted by that.
Indeed. I went in on instructions once to ask that they support us on one of the UN bodies to deal with drugs. And this very smart young man opposite me, and beautifully turned out, excellent tailoring, said, "Ah, yes, Dr. Hoare, Britain and China do have a special relationship over drugs, don't we?" opium war.
Jeffrey, was Prime Minister Lee, do you think, going a bit off-piste by talking about Scotland? We have seen various American panjandrums contributing to this discussion as well.
The question is whether David Cameron thought it was going, that helps him or hurts him. I think it is rather interesting to see a country given Tibet. The subtext of everything that China says has so many more meanings than the words themselves. And is it off-piste? Of course, in terms of international diplomacy, it is. But evidently, if you can arrange demand meetings with the Queen, you can also tell Scotland where it should stay put.
And after all, the Pope has indicated that he would prefer Scotland not to leave the Union.
Well, so again,
it's getting very common.
That's very much an endorsement that could go one of two ways in Scotland. David Cameron did make the point at one of their joint photo calls that there's been more Chinese investment in the UK in the last 18 months than the previous 30 years. Jim, why would that be the case?
Contracts signed earlier have come into fruition, I should think. But, I mean, you have to be very careful with these sort of statements by politicians about how it's been done on their watch. Okay, I don't know the figures, to be honest, but nothing that's been done in the last 18 months was only done in the last 18 months. It will have started long before. And if you look, British ministers, including prime ministers, go to China very regularly, except when we've offended the Chinese over one thing or another, usually Tibet. There is, behind all that, there is a fairly steady set of negotiations on trade matters that goes on. As I say, I think you're seeing things coming to fruition that have been a long time in play.
I think what's sobering about reading, I'm sure you're right, but at the same time, the scale of Chinese investment here, in particular, I think people outside of the UK may, and maybe inside the UK may not be aware that China is actually helping build a nuclear power plant for the UK, and which seems a little shocking to a lot of people here, this notion that something as sensitive and volatile as a nuclear power plant could be owned by a country as volatile as China. And while they will not have a 40% stake at most, one presumes that they're not going to have some sort of remote control in Beijing that says, okay, enough of those Brits, let's press the button. But there is that, I think that kind of Cold War fear has some grounding. And the notion that all politics come down to economics is really profound in this country these days. David Cameron really is the salesman in chief here.
Well, they are also apparently going to invest in HS2, so China will be spending billions of their money to make it possible for us to get to Birmingham 10 minutes quicker. Thanks for that, China. We will have to leave it there. Journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman, former British Shah d'Affaires in Pyongyang, Jim Hoare of SOAS. Thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's installment of Midori House. Steve Bloomfield will continue our Quality of Life series by analysing how screwed homebuyers in London really are. We'll ask the author of Spanish football book La Roca, Jimmy Burns, how screwed Spanish football really is. And Kathy Rensenbrink from The Bookseller will explain to prospective book buyers how they can be not screwed with their choice of the current literature purchases. But before we get started on all that, here is James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
Iraqi government forces are continuing to battle Sunni Muslim militants for control of the country's biggest oil refinery. Officials insisted security forces were in full control of the Baiji refinery, about 200 kilometres north of the capital Baghdad. But militants led by the jihadist Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIS, have surrounded the facility. Iraq has asked for US airstrikes on the militants. US President Barack Obama is to make a statement imminently. Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian separatists have been locked in fierce fighting in the east of Ukraine today, while a rebel commander has acknowledged big losses among separatists heavily outgunned by government forces. Even as President Petro Poroshenko and his team prepare to unveil their blueprint for ending more than 2 months of rebellion, government forces, using artillery and heavy armour, say they've tightened the noose on separatists near Krasny Liman, north of the main regional hub of Donetsk. A Turkish court has today ordered the release of 230 military officers convicted of plotting to topple Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan. The announcement comes a day after the country's top court ruled their trial was flawed. And the new king of Spain has called for people to work together to rebuild the country as it recovers from the economic crisis. Felipe VI has officially taken over from his father Juan Carlos after he abdicated earlier this month. That's the latest news at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's time now to look at the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is on a newsstand near you now. It's our annual Quality of Life edition, and all week on Midori House, we've been hearing from our editors and correspondents on what makes a city great, or not so. Today, it's the turn of our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who looks around Monocle's hometown of London and the topic that obsesses it beyond any other, housing, or the lack of it affordable to mortals.
On a Saturday afternoon in East London, the queue outside a small Victorian terrace house snakes around the corner. Dozens of people have come to view a tiny flat. One bedroom, a kitchen come living room, no garden. The price, £350,000. And by Monday morning, more than 20 of those squeezing past each other to take a look at the shower will have made an offer. By the evening, it will have sold for £50,000 more than the asking price. London's housing problem has become too big to ignore. Prices are too high, whether buying or renting, and there aren't enough homes to go around. That much everyone can agree on. The difficult part is working out what to do next. Even the concrete or bricks and mortar answers are vague. Build more houses is a simple slogan, one spouted by politicians, campaigners, and pretty much everyone who wants somewhere to live or somewhere better to live. That's fine, except A, it's not happening, and B, it's more complicated than that. There are, however, several other things that can be done to reform the housing market. Firstly, make it cheaper. Renting used to be the cheap option. No longer. Average rents are now higher than average mortgage repayments. This makes it harder to buy for two main reasons. Firstly, people cannot save enough for deposits. Secondly, it makes buy-to-let an attractive investment, which increases competition for the few homes on the market. If that means rent controls, so be it. Two, make it easier to rent. Tenancy contracts tend to last just 1 year, preventing families putting down roots in their local community, particularly if landlords increase rent at a faster pace than wages, forcing people to move out. Longer-term tenancy agreements should be encouraged. Dodgy landlords, failing to fix things, refusing to return deposits, need to be weeded out. Introduce a landlord's register, banning those who break the law. 3. Make it harder for investors to buy properties and then leave them empty. A house in London provides a far better return than almost any other investment. Why put your money in the stock market when the past few years would have given double-digit growth on a new build apartment? Foreign buyers will continue to see property in more stable economies as a smart investment. But if it means one less home for those that live here, or want to live here, we can't just shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's globalisation. 4. Reform the buying process. Make the bidding process open, ending the farce of estate agents artificially pushing up prices by demanding sealed bids. Make the acceptance of a formal offer legally binding. This happens in Scotland and the sky hasn't fallen in. This will prevent gazumping when a house is sold for a higher price to someone else, as well as the bizarre new form of torture, ghost gazumping, when a buyer is told they have to pay more or lose the property. 5. Yes, build more houses. Local councils should be allowed to borrow to build. Penalties should be introduced for companies that buy land and build nothing. And rules on affordable housing should be enforced. Planning regulations also need to be changed. It's far too easy to block new developments. This will mean building on so-called greenfield sites. But remember, greenfield sites are not necessarily green fields. We need homes more than we need nice views. London's housing market works for the lucky few whose homes have dramatically increased in value. For everyone else, the majority, it's failing. If London is to remain one of the greatest cities in the world, then Londoners need to be able to actually live here. For Monocle, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
Steve Bloomfield on London's housing bubble. Up next, we'll be talking Spain and football with Jimmy Burns. Stay tuned to find out more on Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Spare a thought for Vincent Del Bosque, the manager of Spain's football team, who arrived in Brazil as defending world champions, will currently be writing a pre-match team talk for a meaningless fixture against Australia, while his players research false beards and or clothing that provides the best protection against barrages of tomatoes in preparation for their earlier than anticipated return home. So what went wrong? Well, short answer, everything. For the longer answer, I'm joined now by Jimmy Burns, journalist and author, most pertinently, of the book La Roca, A Journey Through Spanish Football. Jimmy, were you surprised by what has happened?
Well, I was surprised because on the basis of the Spanish team's obvious achievements and where it's got to. I mean, let's not forget that it's already made history by winning two European Cups in succession and winning the last World Cup. It was, came to this tournament as definitely among the favourites. And as you pertinently put in your introduction with some humour, everything that went wrong or could have gone wrong went wrong, but one didn't expect everything to go wrong, but it did.
Because we weren't really braced for the idea of an empire in decline, and then we're just a few weeks away, really, from a European Cup final, which was a Madrid derby.
Well, I mean, that's a good point, because I think, you know, inevitably there's a lot of talk about this is the end of an era, and, you know, we've been there before, with obviously with Brazil, the great Brazil of the Jogo Bonito, that suddenly, you know, having won two World Cups, disappeared, although they're back again. And then, of course, the brilliant orange of Holland, and then France crashed out after winning the World Cup, as did Italy. But, I mean, you've made the point there and then that let's not forget, you know, the power of Spanish club football and the extraordinary pool of talent that can be drawn on. And I think that's the key point in terms of taking this story into the future, because, I mean, you know, whoever takes over as the new manager, and I strongly suspect that De Rosque, if he hasn't already offered his resignation, will do so fairly soon, and it will probably be accepted. We'll have a complete slate to begin with, but can draw on, you know, lots of very good star young players who are playing in very competitive leagues, including the Spanish League and Bundesliga and the Premier League, who can reform and rebuild into a great team. I mean, Spain could well be into a kind of transition period, but, I mean, you know, the next big international tournament will be coming up in a couple of years' time, which will be the European Championship again. They must be a big contender again for that. And by the time the next World Cup comes round, they could be hungry again. I mean, clearly, you know, what we saw was a team that lacked motivation, lacked pace. Its whole system, which has made it so famous, it just simply didn't come together. One could bring out a catalogue of reasons for it, but, I mean, let me give you one of them. A big, big mistake, in my view, was Del Bosque using Costa, Diego Costa, who only just recovered from a bad injury at the end of the last season, using him in a team that simply was not used to playing with him as almost a lone striker, and also a striker that doesn't have a tendency to track back. So that was a big mistake. And then clearly there were players there who were beyond their, showed that they were beyond their sell-by date. I mean, no more humiliating image than to see the great Casillas, the captain of the team, the goalkeeper, but literally playing as if he was a sort of third division goalkeeper, letting balls through his hands, coming out when he shouldn't have come out. I mean, really a very pathetic scene indeed.
Well, I mean, everything you're saying is absolutely true. What was extraordinary about Spain wasn't merely that they were just beaten or unlucky. They were terrible, and I'm slightly biased being Australian, but I'm not sure I'd bet heavily on Spain knocking Australia over either. How much of a sense of humour do you think the folks back home are likely to have about this?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't, and I talk as someone who's half British and half Spanish, I wouldn't say a sense of humour is something that I would characterise the Spaniards for, unlike the Aussies, you know. And I have to say that the Socceroos have really, really impressed me, and I think they could really be in with a good shout of beating utterly demoralised Spain. Although, I mean, you know, what the Spaniards do care about at the end of the day, although you might say they've given that up, is honour. And, you know, for them to be beaten by with due respect, by Australia in the final game and go out of this tournament having lost all three games and being bottom of their group would be the ultimate humiliation. It would be like the sort of the ultimate kick in the balls, really.
So what next for Spain? Are we now in the sort of dreaded transition rebuilding, or will they resume their life as perennial underachievers?
No, I don't see them going back to perennial underachievers. I mean, I think the key is going to be, you know, obviously on the basis, as I said before, that I think Del Bosque, his position is pretty unsustainable, that Del Bosque will be replaced. The key will be what kind of person they come in. I mean, the challenge of modern football, as you well know, it's incredibly competitive, huge pressure on players. You really got to have a manager that has to keep his game up and has to be prepared to evolve, to make changes if needed, and to be a great psychologist. I mean, where I think Del Bosque clearly failed on this World Cup was he just didn't keep up. I mean, he played too many players, as I've said before, who showed evidence of being beyond their sell-by date. He didn't take enough risks. He didn't, for instance, bring in the squad enough young blood. And what we're seeing in this tournament, including the Socceroos, is this sort of incredible energy of young players being given, you know, their first chance, and they're really hungry, you know. And when you've got hunger, you've got real football. You've got attacking football. You've got football with pace, and you've got goals. I mean, the tragedy about Spain is the lack of goals. You know, I mean, La Roja at its best not only played fantastic, fluid, poetic, moving, passing, quick passing, possession football, but scored some brilliantly creative goals. We saw none of that this time. And tell you the truth, I mean, for me, it's a tragedy. I felt very, very sad last night. I'm just getting over it now. But because I think, you know, those of us who love football, La Roja and Del Bosque have brought us many, many enjoyable matches, memorable matches, and I think have had a huge impact on modern football. I mean, you know, a lot of people have taken up their style of playing. I mean, look at Liverpool now with Rodgers. You know, even Mourinho has had to pinch a few ideas. But as I say, football is constantly evolving, and you've just got to keep pace. And I think Del Bosque looked like a man who completely lost the plot.
Jimmy Burns, author of La Roja, A Journey Through Spanish Football, thank you very much for joining us. It's time now for a bit of music. We are, of course, while the World Cup is on, playing a few alternative national anthems of the competing sides. These are songs that capture some of the spirit of each of the 32 nations battling it out in Brazil. Right now, we should probably focus on Spain while we just about still can. As our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous explained, it's one pop song written by Belgians, which was a hit for a Swede in the UK, that still unites the Spaniards.
Spain does have a national anthem, but it doesn't have any words. Obviously, there's in a nation of people who love to sing, it's kind of an awkward moment when the national anthem plays and people are just left standing and don't know what to say. So there has been a few songs that have filled the void. The main one is an amazing song called Que Viva España by Manolo Escobar, which actually became a hit from its very inception in 1973.
Entre flores, fandanguillo y alegría. Nació mi España, la tierra del amor.
And the interesting thing is, it actually isn't a Spanish song. It was actually imported from the Flanders region in Belgium. It was actually first sung in Flemish in 1971 by the infamous singer Samantha.
Na die mooie warme reis door het zonnige Spanje, vergeet ik alles, ik denk alleen op Spaans.
And then in 1973, it was kind of poached by Manolo Escobar, who was already a very famous folk singer, and it became a hit all across Europe, actually. It even managed to creep into the UK charts in 1974, and it reached number four and stayed on the UK charts for 6 months. So it's a very popular tune.
Por eso se oye este refrán, que viva.
It's one of the few low-key, if I can use that term, ways of expressing patriotism in Spain. Being nationalistic in Spain is still very taboo. It's a carryover from the country's dictatorship. Probably another reason why there aren't any lyrics to that national anthem. People just couldn't agree on what to actually sing about. But there are very rare moments where the country comes together, one of them being actually when Spain won the World Cup in 2010. And the song that the La Roja, the Spanish team, was actually singing was, you guessed it, Que Viva España. And at the celebrations in Madrid, when they returned, the captain of the team pulled up a man wearing this spectacularly tacky and very patriotic red and yellow suit to sing this song. And it was actually Manolo Escobar. It was one of his last great performances before he died in 2013 at the age of 82.
La vida viene a paso y España es la mejor.
It was a sad moment. People obviously mourned his passing, but they still love to sing that song. So obviously his legacy will endure. It's one of those songs that whenever there's a very happy moment for the country, they're few and far between in recent years, but people do gather around and sing this song. So Manuel Escobar was loved because he was very humble, very kind of jovial and a very famous folk singer. And this song kind of reflects his personality, even though he didn't really write it himself. But he really did make it famous and give it a lot of weight and really contribute to his country with this song. It says, particularly the question of nationalism and patriotism being taboo and only really coming or being shown in these rare moments, it kind of says that the country still really needs to tackle its past. It still hasn't dealt with a lot of questions and resolved a lot of issues with its checkered history over the last century at least. So it's kind of good that when there are kind of happy moments, Spain does win the World Cup, that they can join hands and sing this song at the top of their lungs and not be ashamed about being proud of their country. Well, I have to say, it's quite difficult when you move to a country like Spain and there's so many of these folk songs that everyone knows the words to, there's even dances to every song, and you've kind of left out, but the longer you stay here, the more lyrics you learn and the more you feel a bit more Spanish. But I'm not a singing man, my voice is admittedly not the best, but you might see me at least kind of mouthing my lips just so I'm not heard above the fray, but just so I'm not like the kind of sourpuss in the room not singing. I try to join as much as I can.
Liam Aldous there on Y Viva España, which you will now be humming to yourself for the next month without really understanding why. Apologies in advance. We have reached a part of Midori House where we review one particular aspect of the arts. Today it's books, and I'm joined by Kathy Rensenbrink, a project director at Quick Reads and associate editor of The Bookseller, and we love this book. Kathy, welcome back to the show as ever. The first book you wanted to bring our attention is it's kind of a book about books or a book about literature or really a book about kind of dealing at one remove with the laziest author in history.
I do. I think books about books is probably my favourite subgenre of books. So yes, I've unusually chosen a memoir, and it's My Salinger Year by Joanna Rakoff. And it just is completely sublime. And I'd heard lots of good things about it, so I slightly thought, can this book be as good as people are saying it is? And it completely is.
Because she was rather gifted this story, wasn't she, by via her job.
That's right. So she became an agent's assistant at a literary agency in New York, and then got the job without realizing that a few days later she'd have a conversation that at some point she'd have to learn to not tell anyone about Jerry. And J.D. Salinger is on their list, and then it's her job to cope with the fan mail that he gets, which he doesn't want to be passed on to him.
I'm not surprised. He must get some live ones, J.D. Salinger.
Absolutely.
I would think.
She starts writing back to them. They don't appreciate being written back to by her, patronising them about her problems when they wanted a letter back from Salinger. And eventually he materialises. But there's lots of other good stuff as well. A truly hideous boyfriend, a terrible apartment. The boyfriend's writing a novel. The novel's dreadful. She sort of knows it's dreadful. It's absolutely blissful.
Because it does sound like the kind of thing that could have been insufferable if handled badly.
I definitely, you're sort of right that she was gifted this story to talk about. So you to a certain extent, you think, how could that not be interesting? So therefore, would you expect the book to be very good? But there's just the combination of it all. It just pulls together so well. And I think it's a joy to read if you're interested in books and reading. But I actually think it would be a joy to read. You know, I do read sometimes books and I think, well, I liked that. But would anybody not in the industry bubble like that? Whereas I think this has a wider appeal.
You also have the gift of letters from weirdos. It reminds me a bit of a friend of mine who used to be a TV critic for an Australian newspaper. Whenever he thought people didn't love him enough, he used to write things about Star Trek and deliberately get a couple of minor details wrong. And yeah, he used to send me copies of the letters. They were absolutely joyous. Unfortunately, never wrote a book about it. We should move along. That is My Salinger Year by Joanna Rakoff, unreservedly recommended by the sound of it. We should move along to A Song for Issy Bradley by Carrie Spray, which sounds slightly lighter on chuckles.
Actually, it is funny, but it is also desperately, terribly, heartbreakingly sad. Issy Bradley is a 4-year-old girl. I don't think it's a spoiler because it happens quite near the beginning of the book. She dies, and it's about how her family sort of get along or not without her. It's also, the other point of interest is that they are a Mormon family, and the author was herself a Mormon until she gave up religion and took up writing instead. So it brings this other, a whole area of interest to the novel. The children are all very well drawn. And there is actually, there's also a lot of humour in it, a lot of humour from the children, and a lot of humour, sort of rather awful humour around the religious setup. So at one point, this rather hideous woman asks them all, you know, who wants a stick of chewing gum, and then chews it, and then says, "That's sexual morality for you. Nobody wants you to be the used piece of chewing gum." And it's sort of all rather grim, but kind of quite funny.
The Mormon Church, I suspect, rather more than most, they're a fairly reliable source of comic material. How much of the book is informed by her journey from faith, as it were?
Quite a lot, I think. But I think it's quite a kind portrait. I mean, obviously she's left that religion now, but it's not an unkind view, really. And then what is interesting is that I know nothing about Mormons, really, apart from reading this novel and talking to this author. But you are supposed to just, you know, tragedy is supposed to be something you just get over because it's all part of God's grand design and you'll be having fun with your relatives in the afterlife. And the couple in this novel, the husband and the wife, react to that very differently. He tries to sort of take on that belief, whereas Issy's mother sort of refuses to. That's where she starts sort of rebelling, really, about having that belief.
Okay, well, that's A Song for Issy Bradley by Carrie Spray. We do need to look briefly at Harriet Lane's rather pejoratively titled Her, which strikes me as interesting because I think it's one of those things that bewildered men find consistently interesting, is why women in particular seem to have this habit of maintaining friendships, often lifelong, with people they don't like very much. which is what this book discusses.
It does, actually. Yes, that is a very good point. I've never quite thought about it before. Men don't seem to torture themselves with horrible relationships in the same way, do they? Yes, this is female friendship under the microscope. Very well done. Very brooding atmosphere. Emma and Nina meet. As the reader, you know that Nina knows Emma from before, and you also clock that Emma has no idea who Nina is. She thinks she's this friendly, capable stranger who is going to help her because she's struggling with her child. And it builds to a sort of a tense crescendo. It's very well done. I think Harriet Lane's a really good writer. Her first novel, Alice Always, was full of a sort of a similar brooding tension. Short, intense, very readable books.
Okay, that's Harriet Lane's Her. And finally, and very briefly, unfortunately, we do need to look at J.K. Rowling's The Silkworm. There are worse problems than an author can have than to try to get out from under the shadow of the most successful literary enterprise in human history. I dream about problems like that. But how is J.K. Rowling doing?
I think she's doing a very good job, actually. I haven't read the second one, but I'm very interested in it. It's set in publishing. It's about an author who writes a novel and then gets bumped off. And so it's the second novel that will feature her detective Cormoran Strike. And I think people are very interested and excited about it. And you know, more power to her elbow, I think. I've got rather a crush on her, actually. I love all the charity stuff she does, and I love everything she says. And I also loved Harry Potter as well, so
Honestly, I'm on her side. If your last name's already Strike, why would you call your kid Cormoran, I ask you? Kathy Rensenbrink, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our early special guests, journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman and Jim Hoare, Britain's former Shah d'affaires in Pyongyang. Today's show was produced by Alan John, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Johan Lau. Studio manager was Bill Luthi. The Urbanist is next, presented by David Michon. Then at 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Daily at 2200 London, but I've already told you that. This show returns, also hosted by me, you lucky people, tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.